Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Aparuta de sangamatasa tavara ye sorvantabha munjantu satam. So this afternoon is opportunity to reflect on Dhamma the way it is. And so like Dhamma is not, you can't define it really. Because that's what you actually are. You're the Dhamma consciousness, pure conscious awareness. So when you try to find Dhamma or define it, then you end up with intellectual explanations like absolute reality or absolute truth. But what does that mean in terms of here and now? So Dhamma is apparent here and now and timeless. So I've said this many times just to remind you that consciousness is here and now and timeless. But you can't find it. You can't objectify it. It's like trying to find yourself. When you identify with the body, then you don't have to look very far. When you see yourself as a physical man or woman, then it's easy to observe that. And that's what ignorance does. We define ourselves with what we're not. So then what we define ourselves with is a body that's going to get old, get sick and die, we define ourselves as male or female, or any other gender identity. We want to define who we are according to some word that we identify with. So that's just the problem of culture, of social conditioning. The ego is based on these illusions that we have about ourselves. And so when we try to find out who we really are, we're looking for something that's here and now. And what is here and now is that each one of you know you're conscious. But can you define it? It's not, we see consciousness as seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking, but all these are impermanent and change according to conditions. So sensory consciousness is objective. When you have eyes and you can see objects with them, or ears, you hear sounds. So we live a life based on the illusion of I am this person, this personality, this is my true nature. We get very defensive about it, or we feel inferior or superior, or even we might be more liberal, think we're all equal. But how are we all equal on a physical level? You know, some people are taller, shorter, fatter, thinner, and there's no equality in the forms. But the ego is an acquired condition. You didn't ask for your ego. It just happens to be you acquire it through the conditioning process after birth. And that ego is easily offended. For most of us, when somebody insults us, our appearance or what they think of us, and we feel personally offended. And in a community, a Sangha community, people get offended because they take everything personally. Because we might say things that are impolite, or we're in a bad mood, or political correctness is mentioned that somebody's fat is not proper anymore. Racial discrimination, what's that about? Identity with various views of nationalities, of races, of skin color, that's all acquired knowledge. Some of it's useful, some of it's useless, but when we try to define and describe ourselves according to what we look like and what we think we are, then we can, you know, we seek an identity. Like, I'm a Buddhist monk, that's an identity that I've chosen. That's not part of my cultural conditioning. And how do we hold that, the Buddhist monk image? Well, to me, you know, I always found Buddhism very inspiring, and I personally feel I like to be called a Buddhist. Nobody offends me when they call me a Buddhist monk. And I remember even being called Dalai Lama once, or Mahatma Gandhi. It didn't offend me. But then sometimes you're called skinhead, and that's not very polite. Or Hare Krishna. Well, that's not bad. It's kind of a religious person. But I encourage this investigation, this sense of how words affect us. How, if somebody calls you skinhead, this is how you feel. You might feel offended or amused or whatever, but you can be aware of that. Somebody's rude, and in Buddhist tradition, monks should be treated with respect. You go to Thailand, you get an enormous amount of respect. And here in England, people don't have that same conditioning to see, you know, to feel that they're obliged to respect Buddhist monks. So it's conditioning, isn't it? It's about whether you're born in a Buddhist country, a Christian country, a communist country, whatever. It has its effect on how we see ourselves and how we define our reality. So in my own experience, it's just this sense of inward observing, witnessing. Is, I found, how I deal with praise and blame. As a person, I can still be offended. But as the witness to the person, there's no offense. So this is the end of suffering, the escape from birth and death, from this illusion, this false identity that we suffer from. This is called mindfulness or awareness, because awareness is consciousness. And then consciousness is not limited to the limitation of your physical form. Well, we tend to assume it is, like in the Western materialist attitudes of the present time, consciousness is something internal in the brain or somewhere in the body. So the word consciousness is a word that invites a lot of definition. Superior consciousness, unconsciousness. But in this consciousness actually means knowing here and now. And at this very moment, we all know we're here and the time is now. You may look at a clock or your watch and see the time as recorded by a machine. But time as reality is always now. An experience in this form is always now, here and now. So reflect on this. Keep reminding yourself when you feel offended by what somebody says to you. This is opportunity to be the witness. Are you the person who's going to be offended and carry a grudge or anger or resentment over what somebody says to you that offends you? Are you going to carry that around for a few days? Because we can do that. And then we form opinion about whoever insulted me, and then the tendency to want to put them down in some way, whether I do it verbally or mentally, say they're just rude or crude or impolite or improper. These are ways of describing people who offend you. Insensitive, boorish, stupid, and on and on ways, words that in our minds put down somebody who doesn't agree with this or says something we don't like to hear. But being called stupid or ugly or whatever, in terms of awareness, is a condition that arises according to condition. If nobody says, insults me, then I don't, the conditions for being angry and upset and revengeful are not present. But when confronted with some insult or offense, then I can, you know, the tendency to build up these negative words to describe that person as a bad monk or a bad nun, or they don't understand the Vinaya, they're rude, vulgar. Or one can be the witness to the feeling of one's ego being insulted. It's like this. And that does not, the condition is always here and now, or the situation is here and now. So consciousness can't be offended. Because it's basically pure and timeless, unaffected by good or bad, right or wrong, heaven or hell. It's where we're all equal, where we, when we think of equality, we're equal in consciousness, whether we have high IQs or low IQs, or educated or illiterate, or whatever, has nothing to do with it. Consciousness is absolutely pure and real. It's here and now, timeless. Now I'm talking like this to, because this seems very important to me, that the problems that we have personally are always from this ignorant position. Because we can use the worldly conditions, the situations that arise in the present here and now, or clinging to memories of the past. We can bear grudges because in the past we were treated unfairly. So in the present political situation, then the endless kind of retaliation methods of political powers. You did this, you're not going to get away with it, we're going to suffer some kind of horrible result from doing what you did, is worldly Dhamma. It's based on ignorance, not understanding reality, not opening to reality itself, but operating from political views, national views, racial views, class identities. They're all illusions. And in this Pali tradition, we call sankharas, or conditions. They change, they come and go and change. And you are not earth or fire, water or air. You're not a condition. And yet out of the conditioning we've received when we're from birth, when we're innocent, we usually receive the condition that you are, I am this, this body, I'm this gender, I'm belong to this nationality, I'm this race, I'm this religion. All that's acquired knowledge that you don't even choose, because it's given to you when you don't know any better. So these kind of conditions can carry us through a lifetime of feeling misunderstood or offended or hurt. Or we think of our past, our parents, what happened with our mother, our father, our romantic relationships. Our social identities, all these are, you know, conditions that arise, but I have no reality in themselves. They arise and they cease. They're sankharas or conditions or phenomena. So with reflective meditation, phenomena is... all phenomena is impermanent and unsatisfactory. It's very nature. What is born dies. What begins ends. And this is a constant reflection in insight meditation practices. Just so you... at first it has to be verbal and intellectual, but as you keep reminding yourself and being the witness to what you are feeling in the present, pleasant or unpleasant, doesn't matter. Then you begin to realize that you're actually the witness to the feeling. You're not really the anger or resentment or the offended feeling, because this witness to the offended feeling has the patience and the willingness to allow the offended feeling to arise and cease. Now, when we just react by being hurt and offended and angry and upset and wanting to seek revenge, then we don't notice the cessation of anything. We're constantly creating ourselves. I'm not going to stand for this. This is unfair. I've got to make myself clear that nobody can say that to me. I'm going to fight them, or I'll insult them back, or we even goes into murder. Well, pure conscious awareness that has no anger. Anger arises in consciousness and it ceases in consciousness. It has no abidance in consciousness. But if we just react, then we don't notice the absence of anger, because we're creating anger all the time by our desire to seek revenge or get even, or just suffering in silence of being rejected or insulted. However one tends to react to these kind of situations. So this is an age in the Western world, very much an age of political correctness, where we're told to be very careful what we say so we don't offend anybody. And then we're told we have free speech. So it's very conflicting because that's our right, is free speech. And then we have political correct speech, which is not free. You're bound to use only words that don't offend anybody. And so this is how samsara is. The worldly condition is full of compromises and conflicts, because it is illogical and changeable. When you begin to really accept the reality of change, that which you doesn't change is consciousness. Consciousness has no language. It's not about speaking any proper language. It's not about using right speech as an identity, or political correctness, or carrying the belief around, I'm free to say what I want. Free speech is my right. So this is an idea that one has at this time, that we have a right to say whatever we think. But when you are the witness to the speaking habits you have and the emotions that you feel about life in general and about yourself, then you're the witness, you're not the critic. Witnessing is not critical. To criticize, you have to think. This you can prove to yourself. When you start thinking, then you're caught in the realm of phenomena, because it's about right and wrong, good and bad, male and female, true and false. Because languages have that function, to discriminate, to separate good from bad, right from wrong, morality from immorality, virtue from vice, truth from lies. And that's the world. That's why the world is like it is, because everyone's caught in their conditioning, their language habits. So they see everything in terms of right and wrong, good and bad. So when we talk about awareness or mindfulness or conscious awareness, it doesn't have a language. And this, I had a profound insight years ago into when just this silence has no language. Fully conscious, here and now, no language arises in it. And it's the end of suffering, here and now. It's Nirodha, it's Nibbana. So suffering is something that the Buddha used to understand, to look at, to understand. You have to let go of it and really look at it. When we try to understand suffering with our intellect, who's responsible for my suffering? Is it, you know, we see a, was it was I abused as a child? Was my mother mean to me? Or whatever happened that I suffer the way I am? Because we may not even like the way we are because of the critical mind. But the witness is universal. It's one, it's complete and whole. It's not divided into good and bad, right and wrong. So you have words like nibbana, realize nibbana. And then before I had much insight into Buddha Dhamma, then I thought of nibbana as an attainment, some kind of precious state that you have to get. Because that's how I thought. You know, my social religious conditioning up to then was that the ordained in order to realize nibbana, that I would become a perfect person, or maybe a saint. I might identify nibbana as becoming absolutely perfect in every detail, where it's right speech, right livelihood, everything's right. Because the Eightfold Path is always described as right understanding, right intention, right action, right speech, right livelihood, right effort, right concentration. So this sense of being right is part of the language that we use, whether it's in English or Thai or Sinhalese, Pali or Sanskrit, Tibetan. But when you abide in the pure witnessing, the knowing in the present is like this, language is condition. It's not what I try to describe. Can you, when I say it's like this, at this moment, can you describe this moment? And, you know, when you try to do that, you can get tangled up with all kinds of vocabulary, trying to, is peaceful, it's confusing, it's, you know, so we try to describe the present moment, but the reality, if we trust in just the immediate reality of being, it's empty, silent, pure. And so many of us were brought up with the conditioning, religious conditioning, that we're born in sin. So this is an attitude, you know, that when you think of that, you're basically damaged goods at birth. You're born in sin. This can be, a very confusing identity or information that can create a lot of fear. Because you see yourself always in terms of as something wrong with you. And that's the critical mind. It's always, the critical mind can always find fault with you, how you look, how your emotional habits are, your inclinations. You know, one can always compare one's habits to ideal habits, like always feeling loving kindness, having metta for all sentient beings, and then somebody insults us and we feel angry, and then we can feel guilty. because we want to be a saint. We want to be have this kind of superlative loving kindness attitude towards all. So we can suppress anger or resentment or jealousy or fear because our ideal is to not be a sinner, to be not be small or petty or mean or nasty, but to always feel metta and karuna, compassion. Well, those are very nice ideals. But they are ideals. And when we attach to ideals, then we're caught in a realm of incessant change, which is not ideal. Samsara, or the world, is not an ideal situation. There's so many things wrong with samsara. I ordained as a seminarian in 1966. And that world of 1966 is now ancient history for most of you. So from the 60s, mid-60s onward to the present 2024, I've been a monastic, a monk, living this kind of life with a discipline, Vinaya discipline, alms mendicancy. So many things I don't, younger monks talk about things of the 60s and 70s and 80s and 90s. And then 2000 is now old hat, isn't it? Year 2000, it's 24 years have passed. And to me, to somebody my age, 2000 was just a few years ago. What happened in the 1980s, the freedom, the liberalness, all the freedom movements, the human equality, the LGBT movement, the black movement, all this happened while I was a monk. So I don't have that kind of identity with it, or understanding of it, because I was living a secluded life. So I remember in 1966, the Beatles had just become popular. 1965, actually, I remember I was in the Peace Corps in Sabah, North Borneo, and we heard about the Beatles, and there was a group. I was in this very remote seaport on the east coast of Borneo, and they had a group called the Malaysian Hippies. The Malaysian Beatles came to Semporna, and it was mainly a Chinese community. So then they had a movie theater, a small kind of ratty-looking movie theater in this town, and the Malaysian Beatles put on a performance in this theater, and I didn't even know what the Beatles were at the time. And they were, sounded okay to me, the Malaysian Beatles, but the actual local people didn't understand that kind of music at all. So one of the managers of the Malaysian Beatles was like a Chinese pop singer. So he started singing Chinese pop songs, and then everybody came to the theater. This is cultural, isn't it? And then the Rolling Stones and the Mick Jagger, they were all things I were completely new to me. I never understood, you know, I didn't live through those periods. I was in a forest monastery in Thailand. So then coming to live in England in 1977 was suddenly in a Western country, lived in London for 2 years, and people would talk about all these things, and the young people would come and talk about artists, singers, pop singers, and rock singers, and that I knew nothing about, completely mystified me. So this is, because I've lived such a life, then the kind of timeless element is very real for me. Because 1966 doesn't seem very long ago. And yet in the news, the media, present-day media, they talk about the Kennedy era, and the other presidents that existed during that time after the Kennedy assassination, and on and on like that, in ways that the Vietnam War took place while I was in a monastery in not far from Vietnam, in Ubon, in Thailand. But in Ubon, in Thailand, where we lived in a monastery, even though Vietnam was not far away, it didn't affect our lives as monks. We didn't feel any, you know, except that there were a lot of American airmen in the city of Ubon. But in a monastery, they never, hardly any ever came to the monastery. So looking back, you know, when I look back at my life, it seems kind of timeless. Because it is. It's always been here and now, whatever the conditions of war and peace, cultural changes and all like that were kind of introduced into consciousness, or the liberal feeling of the 70s and 80s. And now at this time, after the Second World War, the United Nations, and peace movements. Now there seems to be a reversal towards dictatorships, autocratic leaders, and a lot of the more liberal attitudes are being despised and rejected. Why is that? You know, when we think of in the 70s and 80s and 90s, we thought everything's going to get better and better, more liberal, more open, more fair. And then it changes, because that's the way things, the sankharas work. They can't sustain themselves in their perfect state. Like a liberal political system, a really true and fair democratic political system. How, you know, can you ever attain that really and sustain it when there's so many other conditions affecting it. Power and money and various identities and seek a desire for revenge, getting even, blaming. So in the media, you know, every day you can hear this kind of blaming going on about who's wrong, who's right, and indignation at all the kind of signs of change in the going to the far right rather than going more and more to the more liberal left side or the middle way. But in terms of reflection, whether it's right or left or middle, it's the way it is. And we can, you know, it's changing. So we see the changingness of the situation rather than just getting caught up with our own emotional reactions to the way things are changing. So the changes of the present day are like this. The war in Ukraine and Russia and in the Middle East and so forth. Who's right and who's wrong? And we might have very strong views about right and wrong. There might be very absolutely right views, but then what's wrong is also a part of life. And so like power, like being a world leader is a very powerful position. How many of us could handle power, being Prime Minister of the United Kingdom or President of the United States? You know, when one thinks of the incredible conditions that face leaders of the world, decisions they have to make, quandaries that they have to participate in, all the pressures of different sides and on powerful images of lobbyists and people trying to influence the destiny of a country. You know, this is something that I personally feel very grateful I've never had to experience. Just the life of a Buddhist monk has been enough to learn from about right and wrong, good and bad, and success and failure, praise and blame. Because in the monastic scene, which is well-organized tradition based on morality, on right speech and right livelihood, right action. You know, I feel very grateful for having that kind of condition to reflect upon. But power, political power, with nuclear weapons and all the kind of threats that are being made at this time, all kinds of missiles and artificial intelligence and things like this, there's so much to worry about. Climate change and pollution and on like that. We can spend our days feeling angry and upset or worried because the future doesn't look all that promising. Where before, at 2000, it all seemed very promising. '70s, '80s, everything looked like, you know, the freedom, the the kind of relaxed attitudes and movements to be just and fair, racial equality, gender equality. All these are kind of ideals that we, you know, as a personality, we'd hope to develop and keep making it, moving towards the ultimate ideal of a perfect democratic world system where everybody's cooperating for the welfare of the planet. That's the ideal, and it's beautiful and good. But it changes, the conditions, the weather, the climate changes. Society's attitudes of right and wrong, national identities, all these are changing. Like I thought, the European Union, you know, is a kind of amazing. The European Union, with all these, when you study the history of Europe, it's just about endless conflicts between kingdoms. That all these European countries in conflict. And then the Union, where they all trying to cooperate as best they can, was a kind of an ideal system. But even that has endless problems because different nationalities, different countries, different languages, different monetary systems. You know, how can we conform completely to one language, one monetary system, one attitude towards democracy that all the population of the world would agree upon is an ideal. But then, as I've said before, life in these forms, of the human forms, is not an ideal. It's the way it is. And the way it is always here and now. It's not about how it should be. So even if the way it is confusing, corrupt, unfair, it is, you know, we can still see that the way it is like this, which is non-judgmental. And we can feel indignant and angry and upset, but our abidance is in the awareness of that, in the anger or feeling of it's unfair, it's unjust, it's wrong, is like this. That we can do. So whatever we have to face in life, in a lifetime of one human being, is very uncertain. And uncertainty is the very nature of samsara. It's not a kind of an ideal, a stable ideal that doesn't change, but the ability of that we have learned through Buddha Dhamma to be able to adapt to change, to learn from it, whether it's a change for the better or the worse. So this is a liberating attitude. You're not bound to take sides, or if you do take sides, you're aware of that. We can't help as separate individuals to take sides of, you know, on the right or the left. But because we're conditioned to do that. But the awareness of the left is like this, the right is like this. The awareness is universal. It's where we all meet, where the perfection, rather than the idea of being born in sin, being born is a condition of the forms of earth, water, fire, and air, and space. And their very nature is to change. So one's identity then is no longer with seeking perfection from things that you can't keep or control, but which have their own karmic changingness, to letting go of conditioned phenomena and being the awareness itself, being this pure conscious awareness, this silent witness to the way it is. So I offer this as a reflection.